It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The gap in wealth between white families and families of color has grown over decades. We examine efforts by the Chicago branch of the Federal Reserve to tackle systemic inequalities. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about survival.
Dreaming can help some people get through incredibly difficult times. Madison's Tondalea Taylor talks about how daydreaming helped her overcome a major health crisis and appreciate everyday life.
You want to know what I love? I love traveling, great earrings and purses. I mean, who wouldn't love to shop every day, all day, with not a care or worry in the world? I envision myself walking through the airport with my favorite pair of Black Queen earrings, my cute matching crossbody purse, taking a first-class flight to the Bahamas. I find myself doing that all too often. When I daydream, it was starting to affect my day job. Daydreaming was good to me until I had an unexpected visitor that would put my daydreaming into jeopardy. I had been feeling horrible for a few months. I was so tired, I almost couldn't make it to the doctor appointment. I finally dragged myself to the doctor. Never planned out in my mind that I would drive to the doctor, but I would ride in the ambulance to the emergency room. 8 hours later, one doctor came in and said, "You look good compared to what your body is going through, so we're going to keep you overnight." I suddenly had a sigh of relief. After another doctor came in and told me he ran every test he could possibly run, and he said I had leukemia. Then I called my mom and said they think I have cancer, even though he was truly sure that's what it was. I called my mama because I wanted her to call him and tell him about himself. Don't be telling her baby she got cancer like that one time she told the school worker not to be talking down on her kids. Or like that one time she told our babysitter, "Don't tell us we can't eat our food." Then, finally moved to my first room after being admitted into the hospital. It was the ICU. It was never told to me what stage cancer I was in. I was always told it's aggressive. After 8 rounds of chemo, after 2 bone marrow tests, after various trips to the hospital for infections, after losing my hair, after 4 non-successful tries of getting stem cells, after telling my son I had cancer, after not having an appetite, after many restless nights, after not being able to daydream about traveling to places with no signs of cold weather anywhere, I finally got good news. Besides finding out the chemo was working, there was no evidence of the disease. I got stem cells. I made them on my own with the booster shot, of course. For these new stem cells I was about to receive, I'm going in the hospital for 1 month, take chemo for 7 days. This may have been the hardest chemo I have ever gotten, but I made it to transplant day. Wipe my system out and receive a new beginning. It's like filing Chapter 7 bankruptcy in my body. I wanted to go home and heal there. I'm living my life after cancer. I enjoy every day as my last because I don't know how much time I have here. Wow. One thing I was always worried about is if the cancer will ever come back. The thing about cancer is that it's not a cure, so I'm not fully cured of cancer. I'm just living my life like it doesn't exist. This time, when I daydream, is really to take the trip to the Bahamas with my new surviving cancer earrings and I survived cancer t-shirt. The biggest daydream is really a reality because it involves being cancer free.
Tondalea Taylor's story came to us from the UW Odyssey Project. Taylor was also a guest on the new podcast Inside Stories, which features Madison storytellers and digs deeper into their lives. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the staggering wealth gap between Black and white Americans and a project by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago to promote policies that could help to narrow these vast differences in household wealth. The Chicago Fed's territory includes 46 counties of southern Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kristen Brody is a senior economist at the Chicago Fed and is director of its Economic Mobility Project. Kristen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Your research says that white households have a median net worth that's nearly eight times greater than Black households, and that data taken in 2019. How does that gap compare to previous surveys?
So if we look at it, so the Survey of Consumer Finance comes out every 3 years, right? So in 2016, the average white household had a median net worth that was 9.9 times greater than the average Black household. That decreased in 2019, and it decreased again in 2022. But if we look at the multiplier, right, like the multiplier is decreasing, but the number is increasing, right? So the gap is 240,000. So it really depends on, are you talking about the multiplier decreasing or the dollar amount increasing? And when we look at the dollar amount, we see that it's getting worse. I would also add that the 2022 Survey of Consumer Finance is the first year that Asian Americans were added as a separate category, and their median net worth was $536,000. That's 2.8 times greater than the average white household, right? So, yeah, there are a couple of different gaps that we're looking at.
Okay, so what might be happening there?
Well, we see that Asian American people are more likely to own businesses than other minority groups, that those businesses have higher revenues, that they're more likely to be employer businesses rather than sole proprietorships. We also see them having the highest incomes and being more likely to get a college degree and a master's degree, which, of course, increases income.
And you highlight in your report that business ownership is a key driver of wealth. Is there adequate minority entrepreneurship to be able to close the racial wealth gap?
No, there's not. So we have seen an uptick in business applications and businesses getting started in particularly Black and Latino majority counties during the pandemic, but many of them are sole proprietorships. So they're not necessarily in employing other people, right? And the other thing that you have to look at is how those businesses are doing 4 years after they open. And we see that Black and Latino businesses are less likely to be in operation 4 years later. So we need to figure out, how do we support these businesses so that they can thrive, employ people, and serve their communities?
Turning to labor unions, which may be part of some businesses, last summer a Gallup poll found nearly 70% of Americans approve of labor unions. That's nearly the highest level of support since the 60s. How are labor unions affecting household wealth and the racial wealth gap?
So we know that when you have labor unions, people are likely to earn higher wages. Research has shown that for many years. And we know that African Americans have the highest union membership rate. So that's definitely a good thing, right? And we did see, you know, several strikes last summer. We are seeing people earning higher wages, but the fact is that none of these things alone, fixing any of these things, would not solve the racial wealth gap. It's been going on since 1870, since Black people were freed from slavery, right? So, and at that time, the racial wealth gap between Black people and white people was 23-1. So this disadvantage has been going on for 152 years as of the 2022 Survey of Consumer Finance.
Economists were able to learn things during the pandemic. Your report says college enrollment rose in 2023 by 2.1%, and that's the first time since the start of the pandemic. What can you tell us there? That the enrollment rise largely driven by students of color. What impact could that have?
So, of course, when people earn a college degree, particularly a bachelor's degree or a master's degree, we do see that their incomes increase. But we have to look at how is higher education funded? And so we know that a lot of people take on student loans. And looking at how are those loans paid back? So if we look at the average amount borrowed as of 4 years after 2015 or 2016, bachelor's degree completion, and these are federal loans. So we would see that African Americans borrowed the highest amount at $58,400. And 4 years later, they owe 105% of that. Just for comparison, white students borrowed $43,300 and owed 73% of that. Asian Americans borrowed $49,100 and owed 63% of that. So, of course, we want to encourage students to go to school, to get a higher education, to get a technical school education or something so that they can get a job. But we have to look at how that money is being paid back and how paying back that money impacts the ability to get a mortgage and buy a house, which is another source of wealth.
I think what those numbers that show in terms of the loans and the payback, it helps to illustrate why education alone can't shrink the racial wealth gap.
They could if people were able to pay them back, right? Mm-hmm. So with the ratios that we're looking at, again, like 4 years later, Black students on average owe 105%. So they owe more than they took out, right? So there's got to be some type of rebalancing there so that higher education becomes more affordable for more Americans.
Kristen Brody is with us, senior economist at the Chicago Fed, directs the Fed's Economic Mobility Project that we are unpacking. You can be part of the discussion about the racial wealth gap.